Hello, I'm Steve Wiggins, and this is podcast number 22 of the Saxon Violence in the Ancient World blog. Today's topic is the origin of sacrifice. Well, to be more precise, it's actually some thoughts on what might possibly be the origin of sacrifice. The notion that killing an animal is in some way pleasing to the divine, however we define that, God or gods or any other combination of divine beings you might conceive of, is a rather strange idea when we look at it closely. One of the difficulties that we have in determining the origin of the practice of sacrifice is the fact that people seem to have been religious for a very long time, longer than written records would indicate, and the earliest origins of religious practice seem to go back to the Paleolithic era. Obviously, before writing was invented, we have no easy way to interpret the artifacts and objects that we find. And so it's very difficult to say for sure when sacrifice began, but it does seem that religious leadership prior to the advent of the Sumerian culture, and the Sumerians are variously dated somewhere around the year 5000 to 4000 BCE. So sometime before that, we do know that people had religious practices, and those practices involved specialists who were called by modern anthropologists shamans. Now, a shaman is someone who is not officially designated as a religious specialist, but they are religious specialists in the sense that they behave in ways that are unconventional, and therefore, in a society that has no way of understanding unconventional behavior, shy of severe mental illness, they understand this kind of unconventional behavior as being sent from the gods. Someone acts in a way that is unusual because the gods have spoken to that person or have inspired them to act that way. And this kind of personage, a shaman, is attested in the ancient world prior to the advent of civilization, primarily by burials that indicate this person was somehow different than other individuals. Burials that include, say, for example, animal bones or skulls of animals, things that would not normally be accompanying an average citizen, if you will, who is buried in the same time period. Well, it's not much evidence to go on, but comparing that to modern societies, which exist untouched by the current civilizations. So, for example, the societies discovered by anthropologists in, say, the 19th century, 20th century, where people had not yet come into contact with modern European or Western ideas, we saw that shamans existed in that state as well, and it's easy enough to correlate this with what happened before civilization began in Sumer to see that they likely had shamans as well. Now, these shamans were not officially ordained or trained or anything like that, as far as we can tell. They were simply people who existed in a situation where their behavior indicated that they were somehow different than others. The Sumerians were the earliest people to build temples. So temple architecture, temple culture began with the Sumerians. The Sumerians were also the first people, as far as we are aware, that had kings. These were not kings of a nation per se, but kings of local cities. So each developed city-state within ancient Sumer would have had its own local king. And that kingship, of course, raises some very basic questions. And that one of the most basic questions is, why do you get to be king and not me? After all, we're both human beings, and we should both have equal chance of being king or being in charge of a society. So why are you a king and not me? Well, one of the basic ways to answer this question is to rely on the gods. The gods chose me as king. That's a very easy way to answer questions as to why you're putting yourself forward. It's not me, but it's the gods. Now, kingship requires support, and it requires support in the form of offerings or taxes, as we call them today. And bringing that into context, you have to remember that in the ancient world, kingship and priesthood were actually very closely related. There was no such thing as a separation of church and state. So something that we take as a standard part or a component of our culture is a lens that we use to view the ancient world that is really not in any way accurate from their point of view. Kingships and priesthoods support one another. A king can claim all kinds of authority by declaring that the gods have chosen him, but that authority means nothing if the priests don't agree. Now, priesthood develops because of temple culture. You cannot have a temple without a priesthood. It simply doesn't work. The average citizen going to a temple might end up offending the gods rather than pleasing them. Now, we don't know why exactly they thought that animal sacrifice was an essential part of culture or an essential part of what the gods required. We do know that priests in general were not farmers, and average citizens were. In the ancient world, most people were farmers. It's probably well over 90% of the population were poor people who worked on farms in a subsistence kind of manner. And they needed to have a source of food for people who were not going to produce their own. So people like kings and priests who didn't necessarily have to work in their own field still needed to eat. And one way that you can do that is by claiming that the gods require some kind of food. Now, the average citizen doesn't go into the temple. We tend to think of houses of worship, temples, mosques, synagogues, churches, as places where people go on a regular basis to worship God. In the ancient world, the temple served a different function. The temple was indeed understood to be a house for a deity. Even in Israel, we get this clearly stated in various places in the Bible, that this is God's abode. This is where God lives, in the temple. But it's not a place that the average citizen goes to worship on a regular basis. People did not go into the temple because, for one thing, there was only so far that you were allowed to go in. Once you reach a certain point within the sanctuary in ancient Israel or any ancient culture, you would have to stop at that point because beyond that point, only priests can go. So once you get into the inner sanctum, the Holy of Holies, those kinds of places, these are off limits to the average citizen. As far as we're aware, the average citizen did not go to the temple to worship in any kind of real sense. You would go to offer a sacrifice, to bring your animals to the gods, and beyond that, you would probably not have much to do with the temple at all. Pleasing the gods is something that the priests do. In fact, it's what they're paid to do. Now, people might not want always to give up their animals for sacrifice. After all, for poor farmers, animals are much more valuable alive than they are dead. Your sheep and your goats can be used for milk, they can be used for wool, they can be used for all kinds of things. Cattle or oxen can be used for drawing carts and pulling plows, things like that. So you don't want to unnecessarily offer your animals if you don't have to. And so it's only because the gods demand it that you can say that you are giving up this animal for purposes of supporting the priesthood. The reason you have to give up animals to support the priesthood requires food. They have to be supported. And the support for that priesthood comes in part from royal decree. Kings also require taxation on the part of people, but part of that taxation goes toward supporting the temple staff. And so, to explain to people why they need to give up their own goods for the sake of the priesthood is simply a matter of claiming that the gods demand this. We do know that in every ancient culture that is attested in the ancient Near East, in the cradle of civilization, if you will, that sacrifice played part in their religious rituals. It's something that every single culture did. As I said earlier, there's no way to really determine what the earliest examples of this are, but we do seem to find that it goes back to a very early stage of human civilization, the idea that sacrifice is required of the gods. Another possibility is that the idea of sacrifice goes back to a very ancient practice of trying to placate the gods for taking the life of a higher animal. Most of us today, those who eat meat, don't have any part in the actual slaughter of the animals they eat. The exception being, of course, those who hunt for sport or for food. But the average person knows the experience of being a consumer of meat and animal products is simply a matter of going to the supermarket and purchasing an animal that has already been killed, and maybe partially dressed or prepared, or completely dressed and prepared for consumption. All you have to do is cook it and eat it. In the ancient world, this would not have been the case. You would have had to probably kill your own animals anytime you wanted to eat meat. And people in general, I think, have a sense of guilt towards this. Something that in ancient societies and even in modern societies that are, shall we say, pre-modern in the sense that, again, they don't have contact with the Western world, it has been attested that hunters frequently apologize to animals that they kill or say prayers in advance to pardon them for the guilt that they are about to acquire by slaughtering an animal. This is what anthropologists call attraction revulsion. It's that Burger King smell. I mean, you can't pass it up. You want to eat the meat, but at the same time, you don't want to be the one responsible for killing that animal. And because of this, people attach a religious significance to the slaughter of animals. And therefore, by making it not just killing an animal, but a sacrifice to the gods, well, then you've got a way of getting around the difficulty. Another aspect of sacrifice that, again, points to its origins as a means of supporting temple staffs, and again, that seems to be the idea, the temple staff needs to be supported, sacrifice is a means of doing so, is the fact that many sacrifices are divided when they are brought to the temple. A portion is offered to God. Now, even in the Bible, we see this. That part is generally burned completely so that nobody gets to eat it. If there's no possibility of eating it on the part of the priests or the donors, obviously the one who consumes this sacrifice, consider consumes in quotation marks here, has to be God, because God is the only one who can appreciate the completely burnt portion. A second part of the offering generally goes to the priesthood. They get their cut. So an animal that is brought for sacrifice, part goes to God, part goes to the priests. And sometimes, not always, but sometimes a third part goes to the donor himself or herself. The person who brings the sacrifice receives part back so they can take the meat and eat that. Now, in a system like this, where sacrifice is required on a regular basis, indeed a daily basis, and according to the Bible, twice daily in Israel, there has to be a steady influx of animals for sacrifice. And of those animals that are brought in, the priests are getting part of the offering for themselves, and that therefore supports the priesthood. Not only do they get part of the animals, they also get grain offerings, wine offerings, oil offerings, the staples of ancient society, the things you'd eat, first fruits offerings, things like that that the Bible talks about how you could vary the diet of God, in quotes, by bringing in various types of offerings throughout the year whenever something is ready to be harvested. These things, of course, go to the priests. Now, what happens in the deepest, darkest part of the sanctuary, where things are offered to God, nobody would know, because we wouldn't be going in there. The average citizen does not go into the temple, does not go into the Holy of Holies. And we can assume that even in ancient Mesopotamia, in ancient Sumer, where all of this began, that the priests pretty well figured out that the gods don't actually eat the sacrifice. What happens is that they take the sacrifice in, offer to the gods, but in the morning it's still there, clearly. It's not been consumed. And so the priesthood knows that gods do not physically consume the offerings that are being made. Instead, they are there for the benefit of the priesthood. That may sound a little cynical, but it's actually a very practical way to understand how priesthood would have played a part in the evolution of the idea of sacrifice in the Western world. In Judaism, of course, this is described particularly in the book of Leviticus, but also in various parts of the Hebrew Bible where the sacrificial system plays a part in the narrative. And we can see that Solomon, for example, after constructing the first temple, according to the book of Kings, had to reorganize, or actually before constructing the temple, had to reorganize Israel into 12 tribal districts, or 12 districts rather than 12 tribes. The reason for this was to make sure that a major city was in each district from which taxation could be exacted. You need to have somebody to oversee the taxation. The reason that he made 12 districts is, of course, there are 12 months in a year, and to get provisions for the temple, they needed to tax the people of each district for 1 month of the year. And in that system, again, we see the very basic idea of taxation supporting temple and priesthood and kingship. All of these things are supported by the offering system. It's kind of political. And, of course, as soon as Solomon dies, according to the Bible, the people of Israel split into two nations, the Israelites in the north and the Judahites in the south. And the reason they split is because of their sense that there's unfairness in the treatment of people and the excessive taxation required to keep the temple staff and palace culture going. So, in a sense, we have a politicized form of offering which supports kings and priests, and kings and priests need each other to support their relative status in society. These are the people who, quote, don't work, end quote. They're the ones who are in a position of privilege in ancient society. A kingship that is not supported by a priesthood soon falls because the gods are against that king. And a priesthood that is not supported by a kingship or by a monarchy does not stand because the gods may be against the king, but the king holds political authority. And so in the perfect world for those in privileged classes, monarchy and kingship support and priesthood support each other, and therefore the two balance each other out. And the average citizen, the farmer, supports that through taxation. This system prevails throughout much of Israel's history. The idea of sacrificial systems lasts for the entire period of the divided monarchy. Then when Jerusalem is destroyed by the Babylonians in the year 587 or 586 BCE, a change has to take place because now the Jews who are taken into exile can no longer offer sacrifices. If sacrifice is only allowed at the temple in Jerusalem and there is no temple, what do you do with that? Well, the religion at this stage becomes spiritualized, and sacrifice takes other forms. A sacrifice of prayer, a sacrifice of something that is not animal, because you can't offer sacrifice without a temple. These ideas are laid down during the exilic period, and then after the exile ends, we start getting, again, another re-establishment of a temple culture once the Jews are able to return from exile. Around about the year 515 or thereabouts, the second temple is dedicated and the sacrificial system is reinstituted. That second temple, however, was destroyed by the Romans in about the year 70 of the Common Era, and with the destruction of that second temple, the last temple that existed in Jerusalem, the sacrificial system came to an end. And what was at that stage a visceral animal sacrifice became a spiritual sanitized sacrifice. And this is what Christians also inherited, because the groundwork for this was laid during the exile, long before the time of Jesus. And so when early Christians tried to understand Jesus' death as a sacrifice, they're simply going back to older ideas that had been in existence for many centuries, many thousands of centuries, millennia even. And they had taken that single death which could not be replicated and borrowed the spiritualization of the idea which had already been laid down by those Jews who could not offer sacrifice during the exilic period, and used it to refer to Jesus. And therefore, sacrifice became a once-and-for-all idea. And that raises, of course, the question of what atonement is, another idea that's tied into this overarching concept of sacrifice. But atonement is an idea that we'll need to wait for another podcast. So hopefully this will get some thinking going about the origin of sacrifice and how it applies to our society today, especially in this period of Lent when many people are in the process of giving something up or sacrificing something for the sake of further spiritual development. It's something that goes back to the very earliest cultures that we as scholars and researchers have been able to discover in the ancient Sumerians.